This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Many Charleston residents remember the events of January 2014. Residents noted their tap water had a strange odor. Soon, people began getting sick. Officials announced a little-known chemical, MCHM, had leaked out of storage tanks owned by Freedom Industries and into the Elk River, contaminating the drinking water of more than 300,000 people. What followed was a months-long debate about who was responsible for keeping Charleston's water safe from these type of spills.
West Virginia was in the midst of the largest drinking water crisis in recent U.S. history. National news had been covering the chaos, but no one knew why this had happened.
A new investigative documentary dissects how public health officials and environmental regulators at both the state and federal level handled the spill. The film looks not only at how the chemical like HCHM could leak into Charleston's water supply, but the extent to which leaks like this are happening around the nation. And it sheds light on the sometimes cozy relationship between industry and regulators. Brittany Patterson spoke with writer and director Colin Hoback.
Well, first off, thank you so much for taking the time. And I'd love to start at the beginning. What about this incident particularly piqued your interest?
So I got a text from my mom. She said, did you see what's happening in West Virginia? I was in Los Angeles at the time. And I had family in West Virginia when I was a kid. And I hadn't been back there since. But immediately I went online and I was trying to figure out what she meant by this text. And there wasn't a lot of information about the spill early on, but eventually I found some, like in that first night. And then I found some news sites that were reporting on it. Having done some investigation work in the past, and I guess having this emotional connection, I called up my cinematographer, Vince Sweeney, who is from Virginia, and we got on a plane the next day. And it really just seemed to me that, you know, 300,000 people were without drinking water. There were a lot of unanswered questions at the time. National media hadn't picked it up. And it seemed like there was just a bigger story, and I just wanted to start asking more questions around that.
Was it this bad around the country? Maybe unregulated chemicals had been spilling with regularity, chemicals that you couldn't smell. And if that's the case, then Freedom Industries was just horribly unlucky.
And you spent months in Charleston during most of this saga, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we got there day three, and we stayed. I was there for a full year, actually, and then I was back intermittently for a few months here and there in the years that followed. You know, looking into the changes that happened to the tank bill a year later, following the arcs of these major characters who are in the story, Dr. Gupta and Randy Huffman, who was the head of the DEP at the time.
This documentary takes a turn, and actually takes a couple turns. Could you talk a little bit about why you decided to spend some time in Flint, Michigan, which is a community dealing with chemical contamination, but in a different way?
So at that point, I didn't feel like I'd fully wrapped my head around why this contamination had happened. The deeper reason, not, you know, did Freedom Industries spill the chemical? Did Eastman Chemical cover up information? Did the CDC cover up information? But why did this spill happen? And is it something that could happen in other places? And when the spill happened in Flint, it seemed to me that there might be some parallels and there might be answers in those parallels. So I went to Flint not knowing what I would find. And it was the whistleblowers in that situation, Dr. Mark Edwards, Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, who really opened my eyes to the fact that this was a story about, to a major extent, a story about why regulators aren't doing their jobs or aren't able to do their jobs. And since I had been following regulators in West Virginia, the head of the DEP and Dr. Gupta, who becomes the head of the state's health department, I had in the can a story that sort of shows the arc of people who were behind overseeing these very important aspects in the state.
Where do we go from here?
Well, we need to start coming up with strategies to separate politics from science, to let scientists do their work without having ramifications for finding bad things. We need to sort of rethink the way that these agencies are allowed to operate. And so that means having a conversation about how do we build this wall so that the agencies aren't politicized.
I'm sort of curious, you know, out of all of this, what surprised you the most?
Well, I mean, you see that in the film, in What Lies Upstream, I mean, there's this backdoor session that happens in the state legislature a year after the crisis. You know, you had the year before, you had Democrats and Republicans all coming together. You know, you had unanimous support for the tank bill. A year later, you'll see in the film, I get a tip from Randy Huffman, who himself was shocked by what industry was getting away with, that there's this backdoor meeting where the lobbyists from all the major industries in the state, coal, oil, and gas, and the chemical lobby, manufacturers, they were all in this room literally rewriting the tank bill, making sure that they wouldn't have to pay a dime more, basically making it completely toothless. You think that lobbyists have influence over health policy in the state, but what you see in the film is they don't just have influence. I mean, they were literally writing the law and saying what they would and would not accept. And I think that it's not just shocking to me. I think it'll be shocking to a lot of folks in West Virginia who thought that the legislature had their back.
What sort of reactions are you getting from people?
Well, we did a screening in Charleston back in October. It was fascinating, really. I mean, actually, all the folks behind Freedom Industries were at that screening. You had a lot of politicians at that screening, and I think, in a way, it was almost cathartic in the sense that you had these people from very different perspectives coming together to have a conversation around, you know, how do we fix these problems, and looking at this crisis and how it fits into the entire nation's landscape as something that isn't specific to just Charleston. It's a problem that everyone is experiencing.
That was Independent Lens filmmaker Cullen Hoback speaking with reporter Brittany Patterson. Cullen's film, What Lies Upstream, airs tonight at 10 on the West Virginia Channel and tomorrow night at 9 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's TV station. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:52. There's a flood warning for counties in northern, central, and southern West Virginia today. Rain likely with highs in the 40s. Chance of rain and snow tonight. Freeze warnings for counties in the west and the eastern panhandle, lows in the 30s. West Virginia 511 is reporting high water on northbound I-79 at mile marker 105 near Jane Lew. Both north and southbound lanes are closed there. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by the new WVU Heart and Vascular Institute. Heart and vascular care close to home. Friday's massive demonstration by Kentucky teachers was just the latest in a series of walkouts, protests, and pickets by teachers in four states from West Virginia to Arizona. Glennis Board reports on what the unrest among teachers could mean for schools, for labor, and for upcoming elections.
What started in some of West Virginia's poorest counties has now spread to Kentucky, Oklahoma, and Arizona. Oklahoma first grade teacher Sally Sammons says as soon as momentum started to build in Oklahoma, she reached out to Family Ties and educators in West Virginia.
We looked at West Virginia and said, hey, okay, now's the time. Now's the time to get on it. I think it gave us confidence to really finally cross that line.
In Kentucky, first grade teacher Rachel Cowan says West Virginia's 9-day strike was an inspiration.
And you look at how communities in West Virginia rallied around their teachers and the support they got, and it gives me so much hope.
Cowan has a unique perspective. She got her teaching degree in West Virginia, then worked in Oklahoma schools for a couple of years before moving to Kentucky. She says working in poorly funded Oklahoma schools was an eye-opener.
I just remember one day when they couldn't find another teacher to fill a classroom position. So I had my first grade class and half of another first grade class, and they didn't have substitutes. So I also had a few sixth graders, you know, thrown into the mix. So I was way over cap with multiple students in my classroom. No heat. It's in the winter in Oklahoma. And can you imagine being a child in that classroom?
In these deeply red states where organized labor has been in decline, teachers seem pretty fed up with underfunded schools, low pay, and changes to public pension programs. Educators in Oklahoma want funding for their schools. Arizona teachers want a raise. Kentucky educators like Cowan are rallying for classroom and pension funds.
I look at these budget cuts and I see what's happening in West Virginia, and I look and see what's happening in Kentucky, and I can't say what's going to happen, but I think about my experience in Oklahoma and I'm like, oh gosh, is this the road we're going to go down?
The grassroots action spreading among teachers also raises questions about what's down the road for organized labor in upcoming elections. Wheeling, West Virginia labor lawyer Pat Cassidy sees the teacher protests as part of a broader groundswell of desire for systemic change.
I think it's maybe a renewal, but a renewal from the bottom up, which I think mirrors maybe what seems to be happening among a lot of people organizing with the various movements, the anti-gun lobby, the Me Too movement, the Women's March, the Climate March. There is a lot of ferment for grassroots organizing right now, and I'm very optimistic about it. I think it will invigorate the labor movement.
Cassidy says unions are at a low point of power and influence. History professor at West Virginia University, Hal Gorby, agrees and says weak unions will often lead to unpredictable disruption.
If they actually had collective bargaining agreements, it would probably prevent some of the sort of disorganization that happens. And even today, you know, to those that say, well, why did this happen? Well, there's no clear bargaining entity to talk to.
Conservative analysts say teachers are reacting to larger shifts in education. Jesse Troyan is development director at the Cardinal Institute for West Virginia Policy.
You know, the way that we see education now is, I believe, is going to look fundamentally different in, you know, probably 10 years. It's going to be unrecognizable from what we currently see around us. And I think there's a self-preservation here, and there's just the general kind of human tendency to resist change.
Teachers are also seeking change come election day, registering voters and recruiting candidates who will work for their cause. During a swing through Kentucky, Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez said teachers are responding as red state lawmakers push policies too far to the right.
And what we see as a result is Democrats are winning special elections up and down the ballot.
Perez points to recent special elections in Kentucky, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, where Democrats won in districts that voted overwhelmingly for Trump. The Associated Press reports that at least 28 former or current educators, mostly Democrats, are running for office this election cycle in Kentucky. Many educators there in Kentucky, like Cowan, say they're now more engaged in both union and government processes and expect to remain so.
I wish you could just come to my classroom and meet my students, because you can't meet 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds who are learning how to read and who are excited about books and are excited about coming to school. That's what we're funding. Don't you want them to have the best?
Back in West Virginia, union leaders are canvassing the state, endorsing pro-education candidates. Mostly, these are Democratic candidates, but union leaders are also targeting incumbents on both sides of the aisle who didn't support the teachers during the legislative session. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling, West Virginia.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.